Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
This organic movement that has cropped up all over the country.
The Jews control Wall Street.
This is healthy.
No revolution.
They are touching a nerve.
You pretty thing.
God bless them for their spontaneity. It's an independent.
Bourgeoisie won't go without violent means.
What we're seeing on the streets of New York is an expression of democracy.
Wall Street Jews.
We understand their frustration.
No, my friend.
We applaud their activism.
No revolution.
This is freedom. This is America. This is something we ought to celebrate.
These are the Jews. The Jews control Wall Street.
It's young. It's spontaneous, it's focused, and it's going to be effective.
Along with socialism!
Yeah!
Well, I rest my case, ladies and gentlemen. The Democrats have now sided with the street communists. And strangely enough, or shall I say not so strangely enough, Iran's Hitler, Ahmadinejad, agrees with Nancy Pelosi, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and the other demon cats who are lauding the communists in the gutter. Now, I want to talk about the gangsters in the Democrat Party, because you may think that it's a party of the people. You may think they care about alternative energy. You may think that they care about pollution. You may think all of those things because you're one of the useful idiots that has permitted this scoundrel to invade the White House and his minions to sack the Treasury. The fact of the matter is that the funder of Solyndra, Mr. Kaiser, a billionaire, paid zero taxes for years. Buffett, the Oracle of Omaha, who I told you months ago was playing a pretty good act of Mr. Aw Shucks, middle of the road, middle American, let's pay more taxes. He may owe $1 billion in back taxes himself. That's Obama's favorite billionaire. He's the house billionaire. He's the house billionaire. He's the plantation billionaire, Buffett. That's why he said we should pay more taxes, because he pays so little. And the fact of the matter is there's more to this than meets the eye. Now, I want to ask you a question on the Savage Nation. The scandals in the administration are so great, and they grow at such an exponential rate every day. I may be exhausting you with them, and I want to ask you this. Do you want me to talk about the scandals of Obama? Do you want me to read from my novel? Do you want me to do something lighter? Because I realize you can only take so much. I have never seen anything like this. One day after another, one scandal after another, he's overwhelming America. Here you have people on Wall Street saying they're Hitler's bankers on Wall Street. I have the picture. Blame the Jews. That's the message of some Wall Street protesters. I warned you behind it all was anti-Semitism. And strangely enough, or shall I say not so strangely enough? Not so strangely enough? Take a guess. Who is behind the Wall Street protests? Take a guess. That's right. One name keeps coming up, George Soros, one of the world's most wealthiest Americans. He's 81 years old. He has a fortune of $22 billion. But what does he have to do with the Wall Street protests? Well, let's go back a bit. The Hungarian-American Soros was an early supporter of the campaign of Barack Obama. Remember, he hated Bush so much because Bush wanted to tax him. Now, he has done very well indeed. His wealth has soared under Obama. But do you know that Reuters found an indirect financial link between old Soros and a group called Adbusters, an anti-capitalist group in Canada, which started the Wall Street protests with a marketing campaign aimed at sparking an Arab Spring-type uprising in America? Moreover, Soros and the so-called protesters share some ideological ground. What does he mean by that? What does Soros mean when he says, I can understand their sentiment? Why would you think one of the wealthiest hedge fund operators in the world, a man who almost broke the Bank of England, a man who almost broke the Malaysian currency, a man who gives hundreds of millions of dollars to the most socialist communist causes in the world. Why would he do that? Can you figure this out? Why would he back a socialist group from Canada which wants to occupy Wall Street, copying the Arab Spring protests, which have brought Sharia law, the Muslim Brotherhood to the forefront? But I will remind you of something that Barry Goldwater stated, which, by the way, I dedicated my book, Abuse of Power, with this phrase. The phrase is something I've never forgotten from the day I first heard it, which is, I've got to find it because I don't want to mangle it. I kind of know what it is. I just don't want to miss one single syllable. Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. Moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue. Barry Goldwater, 1964. Play Barry Goldwater.
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. And let me remind you also that moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue.
Now, the election was stolen from him by the gangsters in the Republican Party, as you well know, or else we would have had an amazing presidency. But instead, it's history. He was forgotten, you know, by now. But the fact is, am I too extreme? I mean, do you want me to stop talking about this? I can do that. Maybe you don't want to know why Warren Buffett may owe $1 billion in back taxes. Maybe you don't want to know how the funder of the solar company that's being investigated by the FBI paid zero taxes for years, even though he's a billionaire. Maybe you don't want to know that the solar energy lobby is still calling for extending Obama's stimulus grants for solar power because they stand to make billions of dollars. Maybe you don't want to know who's behind the Wall Street protests and all roads lead to George Soros. Maybe you don't want to know any of that. Or would you rather that I read sex scenes from Abuse of Power? Now, the reason I say that is simple. I thought about that in bed last night, strangely enough. And I realized when I was a young kid, I would, you know, watch a lot of TV, go to movies, average American kid. And I read novels. I read pulp fiction. I remember that I would hear about books in high school, and the first thing the other boys would whisper to me about in the halls were the sex scenes. They would say, "Oh, you got to go to page 52 and read that." And naturally, being an American boy, I'd go to page 52 and read that. If the sex scene was good, I would buy the book or I'd borrow it and read it. Has anything really changed in this country? Why should we hide a sex scene from Abuse of Power? Why? Because I'm a conservative? You mean conservatives are made of wood? You mean conservatives are made of stone? There's not one F word in the whole book. I am not a rapper. I am not a literate moron with gold teeth and a chain hanging down to my crotch. I can write a sex scene without reverting to the gutter. And I did so in Abuse of Power. So I can do it. I can do it all. I mean, I'm a virtuoso here. Now, most people don't understand why billionaires like George Soros are socialists, or worse yet, why they call for worldwide government, a single government for the world. Most people cannot understand how the very rich would want this. What you don't realize is that the oligarchs of Russia originated this way. We now have an out-of-control cowboy president who came to power as a peacenik, anti-violence man against the death penalty, who is now on a rampage around the world killing whoever he likes, without a word of protest from a single Republican. I mean, I expect the hypocritical liberals to go along with celebrating this, as they're doing. I expect all of those who oppose the death penalty to say this is a good thing to kill somebody without a trial, because they're basically fundamentally all fascists anyway. But you'd expect one Republican candidate to show a modicum of, shall I say, reserve in saying while he is a bad man, while he did terrible things, there is a world court. He was wanted in the world court, after all. And he should have been brought to the International Criminal Court on charges of ordering the killing of civilians and tried. Right now, the rebels who killed him should be brought to the International Criminal Court on charges of ordering the killing of Gaddafi. But that won't happen because the International Criminal Court is a kangaroo court, as you well know. They basically only go after people who are in the way of the New World Order. They have no credibility to me. So now, who is it who ordered his execution on the spot? What were they trying to cover up? Why did they want him dead and no trial? Well, let's look at the 1988 bombing over Lockerbie in Scotland of Pan Am 103, which claimed 270 lives, and for which one of Gaddafi's agents was convicted. What is it that was being hidden that they didn't want to come out in a trial of Gaddafi? What might he have expressed or stated, or exposed, rather, is the word I'm looking for. What would he have said about that that the U.S. government didn't want said? Why was there such a rush to kill him? And also, why is there not one person in the media who is saying, wait a minute, why didn't they keep him alive? The reports now say they captured him alive, and while he was being taken away, they beat him and then they killed him. And you're celebrating this? How can you celebrate a thing like this?
Savage.
We're here today to protest against the last 10 years of war and slaughter and terror that were initiated and continue to be escalated by the 1% of society in our name. We're here today because these horrors did not end when George Bush and his cronies got out of office. We're here today because the Democrats refused to end the wars and refused to end the slaughter when they earned a supermajority in 2006 and the White House in 2008.
There was a courthouse break-in in Texas. Five Moroccan men, French Moroccan Muslims, were on a road trip in a rented RV, and they arrested inside a courthouse in the middle of the night. The men crawled through a window. They got into the old courthouse, and then they were arrested. They tripped a burglar alarm. So the officials found photographs of shopping malls, water systems, courthouses, and other public buildings, which they say were taken as tourists inside their van. They found these inside their van. Now, the question is, wouldn't you think that these five French Moroccans should be arrested on suspicion of terrorism? Of course, but you're not Janet Napolitano. You don't know how Janet Napolitano thinks. The FBI Immigration and Customs Enforcement and the Joint Terrorism Task Force is interrogating them, probably asking them what they like for halal meal and things of that nature. But there's an immediate press release that this is not related to terrorism. Now, a few blocks away from this courthouse, where the French Moroccan Muslims broke in, there was a military intelligence convention underway at the city's convention center, with top U.S. intelligence officials, including White House officials, set to speak. But so-called investigators didn't say whether the courthouse break-in by French Moroccan Muslims had anything to do with the convention going on. But nevertheless, you should rest tonight knowing that there's no terror link, even though there were pictures of water systems from around the U.S. found in the van used by five men said to be Moroccan Muslims. The U.S. government immediately said there is no terror link whatsoever. Now, what if it was five skinheads who had broken into the courthouse and had pictures of infrastructure, sewer pipes, and whatnot? Do you think that Janet Napolitano would have said there's no terror link? Don't even call me. You know the answer. You know the answer when you have an upside-down, topsy-turvy world run by an imposter. He selects imposters. He selects people who are anti-American from the top to the bottom. So everything that you see is upside down in the world that you live in. Now you have a president taking the side of street vermin. Now you have a story coming out that the average federal employee makes $126,000 a year, that the D.C. area tops the income in the United States, with the average federal employee making $126,000 a year. You hear this? Texas officials say that the break-in was not terror-related. On the same day, a passenger, an Iranian, yells, "You're all going to die, Allahu Akbar," tries to break into the cockpit. He is arrested by an off-duty Navy person, not by anyone from the TSA or not anybody in the air marshal business, because they were probably in the back discussing their pensions. I would think that if there was an air marshal aboard, with a TSA agent, they were in the back analyzing either how to sue the government or checking out their pensions should they actually have to jump out of the seat and get off their fat behinds and twist an ankle. So instead, another civilian had to stop another Allahu Akbar personality from breaking into the cockpit. Again, we are being told by Janet Napolitano that this is not terror-related. But if it was a white supremacist or a skinhead, of course you know what the answer would be. when you read that 11% of adults are on antidepressants, which basically dull your feelings, you can see how the political manipulators get away with it. That's, in plain English, what it is. That's how incompetence and in the White House, incompetence in the Congress, get away with it, because you don't care. You're dulling your feelings. I understand that. Many of you don't want to care. Instead of drinking two glasses of wine at night, as many people have done from the beginning of recorded civilization, since wine was first developed in ancient Iran, Persia, as it were, people have used wine to mitigate some of life's vicissitudes. They use some big multisyllabic words. But now, with the advent of the medico-pharmaceutical establishment, who have connived to declare virtually all of the attributes of life into an illness, whatever it may be, a syndrome of this, a syndrome of that, they declare it an illness, they put it into the medical book, and then they prescribe an antidepressant for human emotions and human feelings and human trials and tribulations. You have basically a drugged Western population of the West is drugged. Which is why the politicians, how many of them are drugged? How many of your so-called representatives are on drugs? If you go for a job, school district, pilot, cop, you have to take a drug test, don't you? I would demand that everyone in Congress submit to a drug test. And I would have them do it once every month. I mean, don't you want to know if your leaders are impaired in some way? I mean, would you want your pilot to be able to fly a plane without taking a drug test? Of course not. Well, these people have the same job as a pilot. And that's why they've crashed the good ship America into the iceberg. Most of them are either drunk or stoned or on prescription drugs, multifaceted drug interactions. You don't know whether they're stoned or not. Here you had Wiener masturbating in Congress. He admitted that he was masturbating, then going on the floor of Congress. Need I remind you of a couple of presidents ago, what went on in there with Monica Lewinsky? Don't you think you need to know whether they're on drugs or not? I mean, don't you want drug testing for Congress? Good. You should have drug testing for Congress. See what they're on. See how many of them come up clean. They couldn't even get your job, most of them.
Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Springfield, Illinois. Jason, you're on the Savage Nation.
Yeah, Dr. Savage, I think you're an intelligent man, but I think you're off the mark with this, with your view of the Wall Street protesters, and if you'll just give me a second, I can tell you why. You know, I don't think no one's upset that people are making money. You know, I'm a huge sports fan. The athletes I like make tons of money, and I don't begrudge them for that. The problem is when people make money off the backs of people and then turn around and screw those people. And, for example, my parents worked in a factory for 30 years, worked their butts off to give me and my brother a good life, and all they got in return was the factory got closed on them because they knew they could go to South Carolina and pay some redneck half the money. And they would do it.
Who's responsible for the factory being closed?
The owners of the factory, who were running a very profitable business.
All right, so what does sitting in Zucchini Park have to do with the owners of the factory closing the factory?
Because I don't think people are upset with Wall Street, per se. That's just become a target. I think they're upset with the collusion of big money and government, who are only advocating the interest of the wealthy. Everyone else is getting left.
And what would your prescription be for a healthier economy?
I would undo Citizens United. I would reinstate Glass-Steagall. I would set limits, caps on how much more a CEO can make than their employees. They used to make 30 times more. Now they make over 400 times more.
And would that apply to a privately held company as well?
Yes.
Why?
Wait.
You mean a man builds a business and you should tell him how much money he can take?
No, he's entitled to make, just because a business has a right to do something doesn't mean it's the right thing to do.
Yes, Sieg Heil in the new socialist Germany. There should be limitations on the speculators.
So what should the person
do? You understand that you have become a fascist? Don't you understand that no matter how well-intentioned you are, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, that you yourself are now espousing socialist Marxist doctrine that was employed in the ex-Soviet Union? Don't you understand that?
Isn't calling for protesters to be locked up, isn't that sort of fascist?
Wait a minute. Don't turn the argument. You're telling me that a private individual who kills himself to build a business should have a limitation on how much he could earn because you're jealous of him?
Okay, all right, and you have a good point. I do not deny that. But the flip side of that is, what is the factory worker or the employee to do when they do what they're supposed to do and they work hard? And because that owner decides, even though he's already...
And what is the white male supposed to do when he kills himself to get two master's degrees and a PhD, and when he comes out, they tell him they're only hiring minorities and women and illegal aliens. Go look for another job. You'll have to put your life on hold because the ACLU has passed affirmative action. What should I have done? Blow up the university?
No, but you have every right to be angry just as a person.
I was very angry, but I didn't go sit in Zucchini Park. I was bitterly angry, but I found another way to make a living. I didn't expect anyone to give me a handout. Let me give you a tip, because otherwise you're going to go down the wrong road and you're going to waste your own precious life. You come from hardworking people. That means you have a work ethic in yourself. There was once, I never forget when I went through this bad phase, a horrible black phase when my life was taken from me by the ACLU. I could have gone off the rails, believe me. I was this close to losing it all. I was this close with two young children. I had no hope, no future. It was absolutely abysmal. There was no jobs for me. And I was laughed at by the white male liberals who were running the universities. And the reason they hired minorities and women is because there was no competition for them that way. Let me lay it on the line for you. Because I know what those white male professors did. They were forced to retire, and then they gave themselves jobs again after they retired as consultants under full pay. I know how the university system was rigged by these white liberal professors who told me to drop dead after they gulled me into the PhD. But let me keep going here. You're a hardworking man. So here's a story I heard when I was in the down and out phase. A woman was sitting on a park bench, and someone overheard her talking to a man who was depressed, and he said, "The world owes me a living. I did so much, they owe me a living." The woman quietly said to him, "Yes, the world owes you a living, but you have to go out and find it." I'm telling you, that could turn your life around. Otherwise, you're going to walk around with embitterment, and you know what? At the end of the day, you're not going to get anything from any of this. No matter how much you scream and cry, do you actually think you're going to change the system by sitting in a dirty park with a bunch of idiots who are just living off the land?
No, I agree. That's not going to do anything. I think the problem is that the ordinary person doesn't know what they can do, because used to we could turn to our representatives for some help.
There are no representatives. They're all lobbyists. They're a government of the lobbyists, by the lobbyists, and for the lobbyists. We have lost our participatory democracy. You can join a Tea Party. That's what you can do. We affected change. We have the government scared to death of us. You have to understand something, that the government is using these mobs, these union-controlled mobs, in order to fight the Tea Party. I've watched this unfold. And this started with the Black Caucus attacking the Tea Party viciously, making up stories. Then the unions attacked the Tea Party. Remember Hoffa Jr., what he was calling them, the names? That was the second volley. The third volley are the gutter rats in the parks, unleashed by David Axelrod and the community organizers that he is working with. It's all an attempt to nullify the Tea Party, neutralize them, and make sure that Obama gets reelected. Not one dime will ever go in your pocket from any of this protesting, Jason. That's the absolute truth. We can argue this from today until tomorrow. At the end of the day, you have to find a way to make your own living. They're not going to give anything to you. Do you think the government's going to come down and give you something?
No, and I don't want them to, but I would also suspect that a lot of the Tea Partiers' complaints aren't all that different than the Wall Street protesters, and they're being divided by the rich.
Now you're getting closer to the truth. Some of the rhetoric that is being heard from the more literate members of the protest movement mimics that of the Tea Party. They don't know who to blame. But I suggest they sit in around the White House. If a million people sat around the White House and started to chant, "No more graft, no more corruption. Hey, hey, ho, ho, Obama has got to go. Hey, hey, ho, ho, Obama has got to go." Wait till a million people sit around the White House and we'll see whether or not the corruption and the graft comes to an end.
You're right. I agree.
But listen, to attack the private individual is exactly the wrong decision, Jason. First of all, it's not going to yield what you want. Are you working right now?
I am. I don't know that it's any necessarily a private individual. You know, Mitt Romney made the comment that corporations are persons, and I think that rubs people the wrong way because these persons are able to take their jobs overseas, bring their money back home.
Well, but let's pause for a minute. Most corporations in America are businesses that are S corporations. They are not the mega giant international multinational corporations like Exxon, like General Electric. A family-run business here in America pays taxes as an S corporation and pays approximately 35% of their income as a corporation in taxes. Did you know that?
No, I did not know that.
See, most people don't know anything. And then the individual who runs it takes his profit or her profit, and then he pays the regular federal and state income taxes on top of that. They're taxed to death. But corporations like General Electric pay no taxes. That's where the target of the wrath ought to be. Now, you got to ask yourself, with all of this wrath going on there, why is no one talking about General Electric not paying any U.S. income tax? I would think that would be an easy target, wouldn't you?
Well, except that they run NBC, and NBC...
All right, so you are an educated man. You do know what's going on here. You do know that Jeffrey Immelt wisely bought NBC a long time ago so he could control a part of the dialogue, which never should have been permitted. The interlocking corporate directorships are killing free speech in America. The very thing that the left of the 1960s warned us about has come to pass from the American left today. You should never have permitted this interlocking corporate directorship to emerge where one man can sit on the board of General Electric, then sit on the board of NBC and MSNBC, and then maybe sit on the board of a pharmaceutical company, and then maybe sit on the board that appoints the scientist to the FDA, and then sits on a board that appoints the man to the FCC, and eventually you have a dictatorship of five individuals running the country. No, it's the interlocking corporate directorships that's another problem. And this was once a watchword of the American left. Of course, I've seen them co-opt their own movement.
Savage.
Doesn't create jobs, and the public understands it, and the stimulus program, and I don't have enough time left in this segment to go back and show the graph of when the stimulus was there, how unemployment went down. But what is Eric talking about? Does he live in a parallel universe? Of course Washington can create jobs and protect jobs.
Come on, that's ridiculous. But identity theft is something you have to take seriously. What if someone stole your credit cards and tried to destroy your life? Don't be a victim. Call my advertiser, LifeLock, today. Call LifeLock now at 1-800-LOCK-485 and get 60 risk-free days just for Savage listeners. 1-800-LOCK-485. Call them now. Let's go to callers. Joe in New York on line four. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, doctor. Finally, I bow down to you. You are my hero. But the system is corrupt. Corruption up the gazoo. Now, I'm an ex-Wall Streeter, and, you know, I'm very attuned to what the hell is going on. And these people down on Wall Street, you know, with good intentions, they started. And now it seems like it's getting out of hand down there. But it all started back in the 90s, and, you know, you talk about the uptick rule. And the uptick rule 19C3 was another big one that was passed back in the 90s, and also the machines. Now, do you know that since August 2nd, we started, the Dow was at 11.5, and I think this morning it opened up at 11.570. And since August 2nd till today, we had a 10,000-point swing on the Dow. You remember the wildness the last few weeks and, you know, this and that? I mean, the machines, they're trading for pennies on pennies, these big corporations, and 70-80% of the trading volume now is through the machines. That's how these big corporations are making money. They're slapping bids. They're hitting the bids without borrowing the stock, and then they worry about it later.
What do you mean? In other words, they're trading in such large volume and making such small profit, but they're making the profit on the large volume, so the little guy isn't even trading on Wall Street anymore to any extent? Is that what you're saying?
Well, not written. They're not trading. How the hell can you trade? You don't know what the hell is going on with this.
No, I don't have any stock because to me it's a horse race, and I don't know who's who drugged the horse. You know what I'm saying?
And the problem is the uptick rule. You know, back in the early days, you know, I started on Wall Street in 1980. In the early days, in order to hit a bid, you know, to hit a bid when you want to sell stock or short.
Oh, wait, we're going to get too technical for the average guy out there. Listen, you're an ex-trader, so you know how rigged the system is. But tell me if I'm wrong. In trickle-up poverty, I said, let's reinstate the uptick rule. Let's bring back Glass-Steagall. Do you agree or disagree with those simple suggestions?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So here I am, an amateur in finance, but I absolutely know how to fix what's broken.
You know, when you have billions of dollars that you can pour into the market on a not even an hourly basis anymore, within minutes, that's where we're getting these wild swings. Like I said, since August to this morning, we've had a total of 10,000 point swing on the Dow, up 200.
All right, let's talk about my concept of hedge funds. A hedge fund fundamentally bets on stocks that they'll go up and bets on stocks that some will go down to hedge their bet. Okay, on the face of it, that makes sense. But what happens if they start to see one of their bets going wrong? Don't they then rig the system to make sure that they don't lose anything on their down bet?
Well, that's the problem. You see, in theory, the word hedge fund is really, it works well, in theory. But unfortunately, over the last number of years, it's become so damn corrupt. And, you know, these guys are working with each other. They all know each other. And there's so much inside information. It's sickening. And
did you read Trickle Up Poverty? I spent a lot of pages on this. And the MFA, you know, that's their trade group. That's their lobbying group. The Managed Funds Association. And you know who's one of the biggest funders at the time was George Soros. You know that.
Absolutely.
And you know that George Soros has made more money under Obama than he made under any other president. You know that as well.
Absolutely. And I have another story, but I can't discuss that.
Well, I don't really want to hear that part of his life. But so, Joe, the system is as corrupt. I mean, I have no stock because to me it's betting on something with I have no control over nor any real knowledge. It's no longer like investing in a company that I would say, okay, it's got growth, it's got earnings. Back in the 60s, you know, people would make a reasonable investment in a blue chip or they take a gamble on a new company, and it was based upon something real. The company was making a product or it was producing a service, and if its business grew, the stock went up and people made money from it. That's a good system. That's what a stock market should be good for. But it's all changed in the last few years when the gangsters took over. Isn't that true?
That system is gone. That system faded out in the late 80s, early 90s, when all of these new rules came into effect, supposedly to help the investor. And in turn, what it did is it devastated the investor.
Right. And so it started with Bill Clinton, in my estimation, stripping out the Glass-Steagall Act, which was put in place right after the Great Depression to stop wild speculation. Bill Clinton opened the floodgates of corruption on Wall Street, in my estimation.
Oh, without a doubt.
Oh. Well, how is it that you and I know it and nobody else knows it? How is that possible?
You know what it is? Because the educated investor is either afraid to acknowledge it or we've been hoodwinked. You know?
All right. Then George Bush with Chris Cox eliminated the uptick rule, permitting even wilder speculation to go crazy on Wall Street. And that was the end of honest trading on Wall Street. So the answer is an honest president, an honest SEC chairman, an honest Federal Reserve chairman. That's like dreaming for Santa Claus, isn't it?
It'll never happen. Never happen.
No.
You know, what's the...
Like Uruguay now. It's like we become like Uruguay now.
The revolving door. You know, the people that run the SEC, with the work of the Goldmans or the Morgans or you know what I mean?
Yes.
And what happens is that the government pulls them in. They have all their cronies that they're taking care of. When their term is up, they go back to their
right.
Big firm.
So, how does tell me something. You're a guy who used to work there. You know what's going on. How does a yuck like Geithner get put into the Federal Reserve, and then this schmuck gets put into the... guy is a putz. He's the kind of uncle in a family that was always laughed at behind his back for being a schmuck.
Book he just wrote, Abuse of Power. And that's basically what it comes down to. It's the system is corrupt. We need term limits. Term limits. We need the lobbyists out. Did you know that Google hired 130 lobbyists for this tax-free holiday? Well, you, yes. Yeah, you know about it.
Yes, of course I know. And how about your good friend at General Electric? How many did Jeff Immelt hire to make sure the GE pays no taxes? About 1,000 ex-IRS lawyers are now working for him?
And then they're sending all the jobs overseas. Not only that, they're sending the technology overseas.
Wait a minute. Obama hires Jeffrey Immelt to be his job czar. And Jeffrey Immelt, one of the first things he does is send an X-ray factory from, I believe it was Minnesota, to China, a company that had been there for 100 and some odd years. Talk radio is not only not dead, but talk radio is very much alive. Although the midstream media has been claiming for years now that talk radio is dead, that the empty skirts who have been saying that this is a medium only for fringe extremists or old men, that talk radio is only for old men, I've proven them all wrong. Talk Radio Network and Michael Savage are partners. We've been in business together since when? 2000? Now, we all hear that the internet is the king. And a lot of people ran to the internet with their advertising money. Yet everyone knows that no one's been able to monetize their investment in the internet. Nobody. You see, talk radio is a medium that you can't hide yourself easily in. You can't hide behind a mustache and such. 3 hours a day, Jerry. 3 hours a day, Jerry. Mr. Mustache on Fox. And unless you have a massive production staff who is talking for you, you're not going to get very far, right? But I don't have a massive staff. I have a very small and very good staff. And when you do talk radio right, people get to know you. People get to understand that you're a real person, and they relate to you. What I'm saying is I've proven that talk radio is a very vibrant medium today. People who listen to talk radio are more acutely aware of what's going on than the average American. Although the fraudulent elites, or shall I say the self-proclaimed drug addicts with microphones and cameras in front of their faces, laugh at you. The average listener to talk radio is far more knowledgeable politically than they would like you to believe. And by the way, listeners to talk radio vote both with their wallets and their ballots.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
Here I am, a guy who wrote a book called Trickle Up Poverty, where I attacked Obama's policies, wrote a book that was a bestseller. It's just out in paperback, by the way. I'm not here to sell you a book. It's just brilliant. And I spent a lot of time on one particular chapter, on many chapters, but one was Nightmare on Wall Street, chapter 4, page 79, where I spell out for you the evidence that Obama was put in power by those who caused the crash of the banks in the year just before Obama was elected. And you say, well, wait a minute, don't you then agree with those who were saying that the banks are the problem? The answer is no, because you say banks. What do you mean banks? Not all banks are bad. Not all people on Wall Street are crooks. As I said to you, there's a good Wall Street, and then there's a criminal Wall Street. The Managed Funds Association, a group of hedge fund investors with whom Soros was affiliated, lobbied SEC Chairman Christopher Cox to have the rules changed. In my opinion, they did so for the sake of they engineer a raid on U.S. markets to trigger a financial crisis that they foresaw could turn the election in favor of their 08 candidate, Barack Obama. And the strategy worked. In the end, some believe that George Soros and similarly mined fanatics and financiers benefited in an extraordinary way while moving the country dangerously toward control by leftists. And despite this alleged manipulation of Wall Street and of the marketplace, Soros is free and active today. And while he's still denying his involvement in one of the greatest scandals in American history, that is, while he's not crowing that he had a very good crisis, I'm wondering why there isn't an investigation into this matter. Hundreds upon hundreds of minor players were also involved in this fraud as well. Another member of the MFA at the time was John Paulson, no relation to former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, one of the architects of the TARP bailout. Remember Hank Paulson? Paulson saw the value of his hedge fund firm rise exponentially in 07, thanks to the rule changes that the Managed Funds Association lobbied for. And while he predicted the crash and the demise of Lehman Brothers and Wachovia, the real reason he was able to realize huge profits from the financial meltdown were the rule changes that he took advantage of to line his pockets. Paulson, like Cox and Soros, is still playing his trade, in my opinion, and in his case, a hedge fund trader. And so the fact of the matter is there was a run on Wall Street. But not all Wall Street is the problem. Not all banks are the problems. All you've got to do is try to fix what Bill Clinton broke and what George Bush broke. And that is, you've got to override the gangsters in the hedge funds who bet against stocks. What hedge funds do is they buy stocks that they think will go up, and they hedge their bet by buying against certain stocks that they hope will go down. Now, think about this. How can they make sure that the stocks that they thought will go down do go down? By manipulating the market. And that's why you've had such wild swings on Wall Street since the uptick rule was eliminated. And so, therefore, you are seeing gangsters in pinstripe suits who are busting out stocks in order to make certain that their bets are hedged. This is criminal behavior in the estimation of those who really know. This is allowed because old George Bush, permitted the uptick rule to be eliminated, which needs to be restored, in my estimation. I also point out what Bill Clinton did to favor some of the more daring members of the Wall Street traders, and that is eliminate Glass-Steagall. After the Great Depression of the 1920s, even the most uneducated in America still know about the Great Depression, changes were made on Wall Street to prevent wild speculation. I learned this in high school. Do you know that people were allowed to buy without putting anything down just before the crash of the 1928, I believe? People were buying stocks without putting anything down. So they were able to buy things they couldn't afford, and it crashed. They were speculating wildly. So the wise men after that period came along and they said, well, we're not going to let wild speculation on Wall Street to occur anymore. We're going to make certain that people, you know, buy the amount of stock that they can actually afford. And one of the ways they did this was put in a Glass-Steagall Act, which I spell out in much more detail in Trickle-Up Poverty. And it was in place for all of these decades, the Glass-Steagall Act, until big old Bill Clinton, working to protect his friends on Wall Street, eliminated the Glass-Steagall Act. And by eliminating it, wild speculation occurred. And so as I say to you, in my estimation, as one educated American who has studied this in great detail and wrote a best-selling book on it, you need to take the Glass-Steagall Act and immediately reenact it, and then you've got to put in reenact the uptick rule. Those two things alone would straighten out the wild speculation on Wall Street and start to bring things into balance. I don't think this will happen because the lobbyists are too powerful. So in Trickle-Up Poverty, I ended with the Savage Manifesto, Borders, Language, Culture, and Economics. And it's a 38-point plan. English only, close the borders, defend the borders, defund and repeal Obamacare, reduce the size of government, liquidate TARP, oil for illegals, strike down anchor baby law, export jailed illegal aliens, fire Janet Napolitano, use profiling to prevent terror attacks, rewrite the rules of engagement, save the SEALs, reinforce the military infrastructure, give a pay raise to military personnel for active duty combat troops, impose tariffs on China, offer health savings plans. I go down the list. I'm not going to read all of them. But right near the end, point 32 in Trickle-Up Poverty, your favorite talk show host, Michael Savage, said reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act. It's one paragraph. May I read it to you? This act, instituted in 1933, required the separation of commercial and investment banks. Its repeal in 1999 was one of the key factors leading to the breakdown of the residential mortgage investment sector. Senators John McCain and Maria Cantwell were proposing to reinstate it. This needs to be done while also eliminating Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Then point 33 is reinstate the Wall Street uptick rule. Here's what I wrote. We saw what happened when hedge fund raiders, according to one report, manipulated and rocked the stock market on May 6, 2010, causing a 1,000-point drop before recovering. This is why we must end the practice of short selling. The uptick rule must be reinstated while putting into place trading curbs. Congress and the SEC should conduct hearings and pass new safeguards to prevent the future meltdown, although this may be just a Band-Aid that masks the crisis du jour. Wall Street firms hire some of the brightest young minds, hand them supercomputers, then cut them loose on the exchanges. However, while they produce billions in revenue through their trading, they contribute nothing of material substance to our society. This pursuit of quick financial gain leads to artificial bubbles, inflated valuation of stocks, more crises, and in the end, the potential for widespread abuse, if not the end of the capitalist system, which enabled this country to become so great. Well, there it is. You've got institutions that can be controlled, and I say institute tort reform. Run the country like a business, not an empire. Get back to basics. It's all in trickle-up poverty, but you didn't want to buy it. You thought that I was just making it up as I went along. I have a real doctorate from a great American university in hard sciences, and I study the things I write about. And that's why I wrote Trickle-Up Poverty. But not enough of you got the message. Not enough of you got the message, and unfortunately, here we are. It's much worse than it was then. So I decided to write a novel instead of a nonfiction book. I figured maybe people would like to read a story in which there are some politics. I ran into a very, very prominent liberal the other day in a casual setting. Just it was a pure chance situation. We are as opposite politically as can be imagined, and we didn't talk politics. Instead, I mentioned to him, he's in the entertainment business, that I wrote a novel. And I said, you might enjoy it because you yourself are in entertainment. It's a very entertaining book. And he said, is it a political novel? And, you know, I paused for a moment. I didn't know how to describe abuse of power. For those of you, the tens of thousands of you who have made this a best-selling novel, would you say it's a political novel?
Savage.
Since I am the most important media personality in America, since I know more about what's going on and have a greater grasp of the facts than anybody in the history of the media, I often get activists who work for the very opposition that I speak, who call this show and pretending that they're the average outraged man, and they try to disrupt the show by coming up with nonsense such as rules we never heard of or laws or this or that. What do you want me to just tell you family stories about Fat Al and Fat Al's tuna? What do you want me to just get up here and entertain you? Is that what you want, a comedian? I'm not going to be a comedian for you. You got a Russian revolution going on in the streets of America. And unless you understand who your enemy is, and unless you understand who's behind these rabble, you're going to lose everything you own. You don't understand what's at stake. I do. I have never been wrong about international affairs. I told you Jimmy Carter would disrupt the Middle East to the extent that the Muslim Brotherhood would take over Egypt. Was I wrong? I told you that just as the fools in the media like that thing, Anderson Cooper, that creature from West Hollywood who was excited because the boys of Egypt had tight dungarees and blackberries. He thought that they were good. They weren't good. This was orchestrated by George Soros' money. Jimmy Carter and Brzezinski were the architects of the so-called Arab Spring, which I said to you when it occurred was the Arab darkness, the Arab winter. I told you that. I was right long before anybody else was right. And if you think it's over in the Middle East, you're mistaken. They're burning churches. They're killing Christians. It doesn't matter to you because you hate Christians, don't you, all you atheists? But when they come for the atheists, who's going to defend you? Right now, they're coming for the Christians, but they're not coming for the atheists, but they're next. And it's the same in this country. You got to understand something. We are watching a revolution because we have a revolutionary in the White House, and he's not a good revolutionary. He's an evil revolutionary. He is a lifetime naked Marxist. That is my humble opinion. Based upon his history, based upon the invisibility of his presidency, based upon the shady secret deals that he conducts every day of the week, based upon the criminality coming out of the White House, based upon everything I see, A man who refuses to show a valid birth certificate. A man who applies for college aid as a foreign student and then denies he's a foreigner. A man who has a social security number from a state he's never even lived in. A man who orchestrated the sale of murder weapons to Mexican drug cartels. A man who can be held in contempt of court, in fact, was held in contempt of court, Obama, for illegally obstructing oil drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. A man who requires all Americans to purchase a product from a third party, which is unconstitutional. A man who spent $1 trillion on so-called shovel-ready jobs and later admitted that there was no such thing as shovel-ready jobs. A man who abrogated bankruptcy law to turn over control of companies to his union supporters. A man who bypassed Congress one weekend to implement the DREAM Act through executive fiat, violating the Constitution. A man who granted a secret amnesty program that stopped the deportation of illegal immigrants across the U.S., including those with criminal convictions. Shall I keep going on? A man who demanded that a company hand over $20 billion to one of his political appointees and terminated America's ability to put a man into space. A man who encouraged racial discrimination and intimidation at polling places and refused to let the Justice Department investigate the Black Panthers. Shall I continue? I will continue because you're watching a revolution occur, but they are so skilled at what they're doing. They are so intelligent at their methodology that you don't even see it going on. It's as though it's occurring in slow motion. It's as though by sleight of hand, Obama and his communist cronies are inducting you into a state you will never be able to get out of.
Yeah. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Palm Beach, Florida. Mike, go ahead. You're on the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, I'm a dentist in Boynton Beach, Florida, in Palm Beach County. And right. My patients, every single one of them swear by you. They read your books in my waiting room. They tell me I'm going to vote for Kane because Michael said so. And I want to tell you that because of you, the conversation in the dental office is no longer root canal, bridges, and crowns. It's Michael Savage and how we're going to change this country.
That's amazing because you're in a very Democrat area. Your Palm Beach County is very, very Democrat, isn't it?
Very surprising. They all came in with Obama shirts a few years ago.
Yeah, well, they're wake. That you see, here's what happened. Let's be very clear. You live in an area that's predominantly Jewish, and many of them are ex-New Yorkers. They're lifetime Democrats, but they woke up to the fact that Obama and his gang are anti-Israel. And so for that specific reason, they threw Weiner out of his seat in Brooklyn. That they're friends back home. You know that, and I know that. I think when they started to actually see what Obama was doing, they're actually peeking now around the door, the door that was open for them, and they're starting to see with nightmarish reality and clarity that the man is dangerous not just to Israel but to America and to them. And they're starting to wake up to that. And so now along comes a black man named Kane, and he's a conservative because he made his fortune on his own. He didn't take it from anybody. He didn't do it by speculation. He did it by hard work. And here he is, speaking quietly but firmly. I had him on my show when he was way down in the polls. Remember, Mike?
Yes, I do.
Okay, and I was shocked myself to learn that he had a degree in mathematics and then had a master's degree because I said to him, you're letting the media play into a stereotype about black men. But here you are, a man who has a degree in mathematics, yes, and we talked about it. And from that moment on, he's been on a trajectory upwards. And now look what the left is doing to him. They're calling him a racist because he's not amazing.
Michael, it's amazing that with the truth that you speak, you're able to turn these geriatric population patients that I have in my office who are Democrat their entire life to now vote for a guy like Kane. And it's saying so strictly because Michael Savage said that this guy is going to turn this country around.
Well, let's pray to God that this continues to be a national theme and that Herman Kane goes all the way to the top, because I think he can easily hold his own, although people are afraid that Obama's so facile with his lips that he can run rings around Kane, but I don't think he's going to get very far when he faces him. And I pray that day comes. I think he's actually the best candidate up there. Mike, I'm going to send you a copy of Abuse of Power so that you can read it during Root Canal. In fact, I hope you don't read Abuse of Power during Root Canal. I hope you read it.
Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Sacramento, Steve, you're on the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, great to talk to you. I was up in Sonoma County. I'm a book distributor for the Bay Area to a major retailer, and I was shocked to see the rate of sale at that retailer up in Sonoma County. It's the highest I'd seen anywhere, and next to Marin, that's the most liberal bastion in the country.
Wait, I don't understand. You're a book distributor. You mean you buy books from distributors? You distribute? What do you do?
We supply Walmart stores, their book departments, and I'm a distributor.
Oh, so you're saying Abuse of Power selling like crazy in Sonoma County?
Like hotcakes. I was shocked to see it. I saw all those books on the shelf. I said, is this a distribution?
But how could that be? How could it be that I, Michael Savage, the knuckle-dragging right-winger, writes the best book about the Bay Area since Jack London, and it's not covered by one local newspaper, yet the book's selling somehow? How is that possible?
Unbelievable. And the newspaper up there is called the Press Democrat, of all things.
Oh, sure, yeah. The Drug Democrat.
But I was very...
So you mean, but you distribute only to Walmart?
Yes, that's our only customer.
That's amazing. Well, I know that B&N is selling it out, Walmart, Target selling it like crazy. So I'm going to send you a free copy of Abuse of Power. Incidentally, folks, I have a question for you. Since I've told you that Hollywood, two of the biggest producers in Hollywood have turned the book down for fear that it would offend Muslims. Now, what's strange about that is that if you actually read Abuse of Power, there are Muslim terrorists in it because there are Muslim terrorists in the world. In fact, all you've got to do is look at Jimmy Carter's Egypt and see Muslims are burning down churches and killing Christians. But you don't have to know that. You don't want to know that because it would make you think about Jimmy Carter, Brzezinski, and Obama in another way. But there are Muslim terrorists in the world. So the hand of Allah in my novel are Muslims. But there are two Muslims in the book, two characters who are actually Muslims who oppose the terrorists. One is Sarah Gadon, who has a big role in my book. She's a hero right through the book. And then there's a cell phone salesman in London who discusses Islam with Jack. And then, although they disagree about certain things, they're on the same exact side with regard to their opposition to Muslim terrorism. So there are two positive Muslim characters in Abuse of Power. But I wouldn't want to bother liberals with the truth because their minds are already made up, not only about myself, but about virtually everything else. Let me ask you this. How do you fear Hollywood would try to change Abuse of Power to make it into a movie more acceptable for the distributors of movies and audiences in America? Would they make the Muslim terrorists into white supremacist militia members? Would they turn Jack's poodle, Eddie, into a lab rat because there would be a protest from PETA if a poodle was actually used in the movie, while there'd be a lower likelihood if they used a lab rat that Jack would have a rat as a pet rather than a poodle to make Jack look evil. What do you think that they would do to the book to destroy it if it became a movie? It's an interesting question. It really is an interesting question, to be honest with you. I can't imagine what the idiots would do to the movie. It's terrible. I don't even think I want to sell it to them. I'm thinking of producing it myself, to be frank with you. I'm getting so pissed off at Hollywood. There are 700 independent theaters in America that if I produce this movie myself, I mean, I don't want to get distracted into movies right now. There are so many talented independent actors, directors, writers, etc. You can really bypass the whole studio system. And then there's 700 independent theaters where I can distribute the movie. I don't really need them. I don't need the studio system, and I don't really need the theaters because basically they're censors. They want to censor movies, which is why you get the direct that you get in the theaters today. Basically, they homogenize anything that's good and turn it into dreck. Last week on TV, I saw an amazing movie. I forget the name of it. It was an Israeli movie, and I heard it was remade recently. The Bargain or the Debt. And one of the finest productions I've ever seen. I stumbled on it, and it was about an old Mossad agent in her 60s, going back to her early days 30 years ago, when she and her cohorts capture a Nazi murderer in one South American country, and they hold him captive. He escapes. And then it's 35, 40 years later, and she's sent on a mission to kill him again in an old age home in Germany. Or no, in the Ukraine. It's astounding. And I watched this movie. I said, look at the quality of the acting. Look at the quality of the writing. Look at the quality of the directing. I said, we have to have equally talented actors, directors, writers in America who are locked out of the American film market because they're too good, and they won't play ball with the vermin who run Hollywood. So I said, I'm sure I could put together a team like that. Well, anyway, that's a separate story. I heard that a new version of The Dead is coming out, or it's already been made with Helen Mirren. I hope they haven't butchered it to, you know, to feature her as something else altogether.
Give me fuel, give me fire, give me that which I desire.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Call me at 1-800-449-8255. Albany, New York, on another question. Joe, go ahead. You're up on the Savage Nation.
Hi, Dr. Savage. How are you tonight?
Go on. What's your main point?
Hello?
Yeah, Joe, what's your main point?
I just wanted to say I'm a new listener. I've been listening to you for 5 months, and me and my girlfriend, we get nervous when we don't hear you. You know, we were kind of worried last week because you didn't come on, you know, but we listened.
Yeah, I had some issues. I had to go to the, you know, this and that. People have doctor issues, whatever. So I'm in good shape right now and trying to keep myself focused and calm. I know I become a big part of a lot of Americans' lives, and I know a lot of people listen to me. I was in a supermarket yesterday, and a man who teaches in dental school said to me, Michael, is that you? Is that Teddy? I said, yes. He said, you have no idea how popular you are on the campus of, and I won't name the university. He said, we all listen to you. He said, all of the professors stop what they're doing and turn the radio on when you come on the air. You have become our voice on the radio. I know that, Joe. I have a big, big group of people who rely upon this show. I get it, Joe. I do. So let me send you a gift now for Halloween. Abuse of Power. I think you'll enjoy it. It is Halloween. As I was in, I went to Home Depot. I went to Orchard Supply the other day. You know how I relax sometimes? You wouldn't believe it. I go into Orchard Supply Hardware. They don't even advertise. They should. First of all, I like their train calendars. That's number one. You know how relaxing it is for me to walk in an American supermarket and see the bounty on all the shelves, the great selection of foods? And I realize, as someone who understands business, what it takes to grow the food, to raise the animal, to grow the fruit, to harvest the fruit or the animal, to package it, to preserve it, to ship it, to market it. It's astounding to understand how complicated our food distribution system really is. And I marvel at it. The same way when I go into a store like OSH, I look at the hammers and the nails and the screwdrivers and the wrenches and the drills and the mops and the brooms and the light bulbs, and they're all there. If I need a screw, I can get the exact screw. And I marvel at the capitalist system that permits people to invest in making so much as a humble nut or a screw and to bring it to market, and I could buy it for 4 cents. It's astounding to me how this all works. And I can guarantee you, if you ask any of the vermin in the gutters of America saying Occupy Wall Street, if they even understood one iota of what it means to raise a plum and bring it to market, or to manufacture a widget and to bring it to market, they wouldn't have the slightest idea. But they all know the rhetoric. We're Wall Street millionaires, and the Wall Street millionaires, and the Wall Street bring down their banks. They're schmucks. That's what they learn. That's what they learn. The schmucks went to college for 4 years. Look what they came out. Look what they know. They know absolutely nothing. The reason they're unemployed is because they're not fit for anything. That's my humble opinion. And let me tell you something else. If you think it was easy for me to get where I am, you're mistaken. I have been told not to apply for jobs because I was a white male. Now, I could have given up. I could have joined some radical group. I could have become another malcontent walking around with a hatred for everybody. But I didn't. I had to go out and I had to get reeducated. I had to learn a new profession, a new career. And I had to walk on glass. I had to swim through fire to get where I am. But guess what? If you have the willpower, like Herman Cain said, and like I'm telling you, you can find plenty of work in this country. You can find plenty of opportunity in this country. You can find plenty of ways to make a living in this country, if only you'd stop blaming others. Unfortunately, we have a blamer-in-chief in the White House, a lazy president who got where he is through favors and through favoritism. And whenever things go wrong, he points his finger and he blames everybody but himself. And then he goes on either a golfing trip or on another vacation. This is not a very inspiring president. This is the most dividing president in American history, which is why you have these malcontents in the gutters of America. Make no mistake about it. They do not have a valid message whatsoever. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Now, I understand that I have no power, no influence whatsoever. I realize I'm just a fly on the wall of the American media landscape and that nobody listens to me. I mean, allegedly, this is the third most powerful radio show in America. Allegedly, it has 8 to 10 million listeners. Now, it's astonishing that I've written one best-selling book after another. Trickle Up Poverty was in the New York Times for a number of weeks. And now here I am, this a nun man. I'm a nun person in the new Soviet America, which is how it works in the Soviet Union, which is that if you don't comply with the vermin left-wing rats who run the country and the media, suddenly you no longer exist. Look what they're doing to Herman Cain. Herman Cain is actually such a proud, wonderful example of a human being of any race, but especially so of the African-American, for the African-American people. He rose from a family where his mom was a maid, and his father was a chauffeur, I think, and a janitor. And look what he made of himself. Do you have any idea what that does to a man like Al Sharpton, a man who's made his living by threatening people and faking his degrees, a man like Jesse Jackson who's shaken down companies his whole life and never produced anything that anybody ever needed, never ran a company? Do you have any idea why they hate Herman Cain and why they're trying to disgrace him? For the same reason that they hate me. Because I rose from nothing to become what I am today with one best-selling book after another and a very prominent voice in the conservative media, frankly. If you want to call it conservative, I don't even like the word. In fact, when you say conservative, I get a little uneasy because many conservatives are doctrinaire Republicans and they make me very uncomfortable in that they represent special interests that I don't particularly feel very, very good about. I'm basically an independent. I have been from the beginning. I'm a registered independent, always have been, as opposed to the Johnny-come-lately. So I'm going to go off the plantation for a moment of the conversation for one moment. Last night, after the show, I was invited aboard a Navy ship because it was the end of Fleet Week here in San Francisco. And as a member, a proud member of the U.S. Navy League, which is a civilian support group for the U.S. Navy, I secured two invitations to the Bonhomme Richard, which is almost a 1,000-foot assault landing craft. It's an amazing ship. I've been on it before. And what I like about it is seeing the dignity of the naval officers on the ship. I like seeing the positive energy of all of the testosterone. And I look at the ship and I say, how the heck do they make this thing run? How do they still have boys in America who can shoot a machine gun, drive a Humvee, drive a ship, fire a rocket? How do they still make boys like this? I know they don't make them in San Francisco. I know that they can't be found anywhere in Pelosi's district because of her values. I know they can't be found in George Miller's district because of his corrupt values, in my estimation. I know that they're not found, by and large, in Schumer's backyard in Sheepshead Bay. They can't make boys like this anymore. Instead, they produce potheads who go to film school at NYU and then can't even make a commercial. But nevertheless, I go on the ship last time, having a nice time. The food is, you know, Navy food, not great. I truthfully, I was going to go to Chinese food after. I learned in the pay. I mean, I'm not into frozen. So, I had a couple of beers. Their beer selection was very good. I met a guy on the ship who actually survived the sinking of the USS Pennsylvania at Pearl Harbor. The guy has to be 90. Spry as a spring lamb. I posed a picture with him. I said, you survived the sinking of the Pennsylvania? He says, yes, I did. He said, I was wearing a full football uniform that day on the ship as it was going down. I said, a football uniform? He said, yes, we were going to play football with an opposing ship on the deck of the ship, and I was in a uniform. I said, how'd you swear? Anyway, that was one story. There are a couple of stories about, you know, war heroes that I met. As I am leaving the Bonhomme Richard, a guy came up to me. I'm not going to describe him at all for fear of what will happen to him in the Navy. And he said, Dr. Savage, I must speak with you. And he told me what's going on in the ships. He told me that there are gangs that roam the decks of the ships at night, the equivalent of the Crips and the Bloods, on the dark decks where people are afraid to even walk on the decks of the ships, where they have divided themselves up into gangs on U.S. naval ships. He told me about the number of young women, if you want to call them that, who are coming into the Navy to get pregnant strictly for the benefits, and they get some of the most golden rewards for getting knocked up in the Navy, and then they file charges against the men in order to disrupt the Navy. This is all a product of the so-called feminist revolution in America. And then he told me what the radical feminist women are doing to the Navy from the top to the bottom, how they're actually firing men. And then he ended by this, and I'm not going to tell you who he said who did it. He said somebody knows very well, with 25 years of distinguished service in the U.S. Navy, was reading one of my books, and the book was open on a table when a radical feminist, you know, one of those bowling pin women with very short hair and very mean faces, came into his office and saw my book and had him fired from the Navy just for reading my book. I said, that can't be possible. He said, it happened. I said, but that's something that would have happened in the ex-Soviet Union. He said, it's happening to the U.S. Navy under Mullen. Now, I have told you that Mullen is the most dangerous Joint Chiefs of Staff head we've ever had. He has a very fine voice, and he looks really like the role. But if you check it out, he's another empty suit appointed by Obama. And that's why the Navy can't fire a shot today.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
Talk radio is not only not dead, but talk radio is very much alive. Although the midstream media has been claiming for years now that talk radio is dead, that the empty skirts who have been saying that this is a medium only for fringe extremists or old men, that talk radio is only for old men, I've proven them all wrong. Now, we all hear that the Internet is the king, and a lot of people ran to the Internet with their advertising money. Yet everyone knows that no one's been able to monetize their investment in the Internet. Nobody. You see, talk radio is a medium that you can't hide yourself easily in. You can't hide behind a mustache and such. 3 hours a day, Jerry. 3 hours a day, Jerry. Mr. Mustache on Fox. And unless you have a massive production staff who is talking for you, you're not going to get very far, right? But I don't have a massive staff. I have a very small and very good staff. And when you do talk radio right, people get to know you. People get to understand that you're a real person, and they relate to you. What I'm saying is I've proven that talk radio is a very vibrant medium today. People who listen to talk radio are more acutely aware of what's going on than the average American. Although the fraudulent elites, or shall I say the self-proclaimed drug addicts with microphones and cameras in front of their faces, laugh at you, the average listener to talk radio is far more knowledgeable politically than they would like you to believe. And by the way, listeners to talk radio vote both with their wallets and their ballots.
Who's the best caller who read the book? A woman. Is there a woman caller out there? No, they're all gone. Here, Birmingham, Alabama. Norma, welcome to the Savage Nation. What's on your mind, Norma?
Hi, how are you?
What's on your mind?
Michael, I wanted to let you know that there's probably just as many women listen to your show as there are men if you would do a survey.
You're only the 41st woman out of the 8 million who listen. I had 40 till you. Now there's 41.
Whatever. Also, I bought the book the day it came out, read it, absolutely loved it. I couldn't put it down. I had a fight within myself whether to listen to you that night or read the book, and absolutely loved it. And also,
Norma, I want to ask, no, truthfully, I don't want to pander to you and just build up. Do you generally read fiction?
No, Michael Savage, I couldn't read at all. In 2003, and I just learned to read. And so all I've read is the Bible and a couple other books, and then your...
Oh, my God, that's an amazing compliment.
Absolutely.
That you would not... Yeah. I mean, seriously, because I'm not... I don't mean any disrespect, but I'm not even a Mormon. I mean, the Mormons, God bless them, supported the Blackboard guy. They bought his book.
Yeah.
So I'm amazed that a Bible-reading woman like yourself would go and buy Abuse of Power because you love me so much. I'm sending you a free book for Christmas, that's all.
Savage. Warning, the Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity.
Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
The summer wind came blowing in from across the sea.
It is the Savage Nation. I don't think I want to blow a vein today. If I read to you what Obama's doing, and what the Democrat socialists are doing. Play the music. Just play the music. So here's what I'm going to do. Thank you very much. That's Robert Davi, a friend of mine. Friend of yours. He's going to be on the show at the turn of the hour, half hour here. Because Robert is an actor who's been in 100 movies. You say, oh, I don't want to hear about actors. I want to hear about the revolution under Obama. Well, how much more can I tell you that you don't already know? You have a naked Marxist in the White House who's getting away with it because of the stupidity of the American people and the complicity of the media. Now you have the Republican morons having yet another debate where they can chop each other up. And of all things, permitting Anderson Cooper, perhaps the stupidest man in the history of the media, to be the moderator. This is amazing to me, to watch the Republicans commit Harry Caray like this. So I'm not going to talk about it, even though I just did. So at 30 minutes after the hour, I have Robert Davi on because he has a new album out where he imitates. He doesn't really imitate. He does Frank Sinatra, and he's a big hit with it. And they say he's not imitating Sinatra. He does an interpretation of Sinatra. It's a huge hit. And I just like the guy. He's been in so many movies. Some people compare him to Robert Mitchum, Lee Marvin. Interview magazine called him a later day Humphrey Bogart. He's been in movies for 40 years. You say, well, why do you care about it? Because it's a time in Hollywood that was different. Now, it's true he plays sort of gangsters generally, but he does such a good job at it. And when I went to dinner with him in an Italian restaurant in Beverly Hills, I had so much fun with him. He's a great guy. So he told me that he, you want to hear the best Italian city in North America? The best city, he said to me, that he's seen. Now, don't get mad. I don't know if I should even tell you. He said, have you been to Toronto? I said, no. He said to me, Toronto has an Italian district like New York in the 50s. I said, you're kidding me. I said, you mean like a Brooklyn Tale? He said, exactly. The people, the characters, the food. He said, it's amazing in Toronto. I had no idea. Then I told him the old Lenny Bruce joke. I said, do you know the old Lenny Bruce joke? He said, no. I said, Lenny Bruce once said that an Irishman in New York is more Jewish than a Jew in Cleveland, which is a funny joke, actually, if you understand it. That was 50 years ago. So he laughed hysterically, and I said, the same goes for Italians in San Francisco. You know what I'm saying? It's like nobody acts like they're Italian in San Francisco for some reason, unless they've just moved here from New York. And then they, like, wear the jewelry, and they act, you know, macho the way I... You know, I mean, why be Italian if you're not going to act Italian? What's the point of it? Why identify your ethnicity if you're going to become another bland, you know, Robert Goulet type? At least anyway, just that kind of thing. So I like his portrayals. He has that Scarface look. If I ever read to you what the vermin in the gutters really want, I think you'd get scared. I guess I'll read it to you. What the occupiers really want, the Revolutionary Communist Party's Little Yellow Book. And there's a group amongst them called the Revolutionary Communist Party who Obama supports. Today Obama said his heart is with them. I don't know whether it's with the RCP, but it's with the vermin in the gutter, the vermin in the gutters of America. The president is with them, which is very interesting because there have been mass demonstrations in America before, occupiers before. I know about the draft riots after the Civil War. I personally was there along with Zelig. There was the bonus march where World War One vets came back and they had no money and they camped out in Washington, and the president at the time unleashed the military on them and shot soldiers that returned from World War One because they wouldn't leave the square. the only time that I know of a president who backed street protests was FDR, the first socialist president of America. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the first dictator of America, one of Obama's mentors, actually backed the campers. So you see, he's following in the footsteps of his mentors. You say, all right, so that's not a big deal. So what does the Revolutionary Communist Party stand for? They actually put out a book. So when you see these idiot children in the gutters, what they stand for is, one, the violent overthrow of the U.S. government. Two, open the dungeons. And they want to release all the prisoners from the prisoners and use them to control the population. Three, autonomy for minority and formerly oppressed nationalities. African Americans would have the right to create their own autonomous region comprising the southern part of the former imperialist United States of America. The same conditions would hold for Mexican Americans in what was the southwest region of the former United States. And I don't know if Sean Penn and Susan Sarandon would be allowed to live in the New Mexico or if their estates would be donated for cultural centers, but we'll have to wait and see. I hope we don't have to wait and see. Four, special tribunals will be held by the Communist Party USA. Continuing in the tradition of the French and Russian revolutions and the Khmer Rouge regime, special tribunals will be established to preside in cases of war crimes and other crimes against humanity committed by former members and functionaries of the ruling class of the imperialist USA and its state and government apparatus. That means you. We do not know whether they will import the guillotines or have them made here domestically. Five, prohibition of capitalism. They would eliminate the private ownership of means of production. They would eliminate it completely. They would abolish private property. Six, immigration. This group that Obama supports abhors the xenophobic and fascist anti-immigrant atmosphere of the imperialistic USA, and they want the country flooded, the American communists and Marxists, want the country flooded with as many Mexicans and Chinese as can possibly be gotten into the country. What the occupiers really want? That's what's behind the smiley face of the vermin in the gutters of Wall Street and elsewhere. And our government is not only not doing anything about it, Obama is winking and nodding. So that's why I didn't want to cover it. I knew I'd get you sick. And that's why I didn't do it. I mean, I did it. I didn't want to, but I did it slightly. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Now, you talk about hypocrisy, and I can't let this go because it's right up my alley. It's a food-related subject. And as you know, I'm a food-obsessed individual. I don't know, maybe it's genetic, maybe it's a familial thing, maybe it's a personal thing. But when I read that Michelle Obama, who lectures everyone about eating, broccoli and fresh vegetables, she goes on to a cooking show. And the woman who runs the cooking show says this. She said, Michelle ate more than any other guest I've ever had on the show. Michelle kept eating even during commercials, Dean said. And she taught Michelle Obama how to fry shrimp during a TV segment in September. This is the woman who tells you to eat, you should eat carrots while she eats fried food. And then she said, the first lady has a good idea to get Americans gardening. But in fact, she herself loves fried foods. And she says, you know what their favorite foods are, meaning the president and his wife? It's hot wings. You know, those kinds of foods that are not necessarily top of the list healthy foods. So Michelle's no different than the rest of us, she said. We love those kinds of foods. We just know that we can't eat them every day. So in other words, it's not do as I do, it's do as I say for Michelle Obama. And what trip is she going to go on next? It's unbelievable to me, again, if she were a first lady, Republican woman, from a Midwestern background, not of African-American descent, would she be able to get away with this kind of hypocrisy? You know and I know she wouldn't. And it's because the media is owned by the Obama administration. It's one and the same, the government media complex. Talk radio is still dominant in terms of the world of political ideas in this country. I did it on this show. It was done nowhere else. We kept hearing talk radio is this, talk radio is that, it's only for old people, talk radio is dead, cable news is king, internet is king. I don't say they don't have a powerful influence. You got to be a fool not to say so. At this stage, though, you'd have to admit, no matter how much of a doubting Thomas you are, that Michael Savage has rescued talk radio from the gallows, talk radio network, an independent syndicator. I work with the best team in talk radio. They know me. They're like my friends, all the guys in the back room. It's unbelievable to me. This is a family. This is a team. We are the Yankees of talk radio. If anyone out there has been doubting whether talk radio still is powerful, let me tell you something. It is more powerful today than it ever has been in my 16-year career. Much more powerful today. More listeners than ever. More influence than ever. That's if you're in the inner ring. If you're in the inner ring, you have an audience that needs you and listens to you. And if you make sense, well, you're gonna make a lot of friends and a lot of unhappy people too. I wouldn't use the word enemies because we don't yet live in North Korea. I wanted to pay homage today, homage to Carbon, because many of the illiterate morons in America who are attacking Wall Street, I think 4 weeks ago, were attacking Carbon. Since global warming didn't pan out for them quite well, they've now gone into attacking global banking. A couple of weeks ago, global warming, actually a year ago, global warming was the hot ticket to sit in for. Now they're sitting against the Zionist bankers, I guess. But of course, most of these idiots, these uneducated morons, some of whom have higher degrees and God knows what, think that Carbon is the enemy. I mean, I should remind them that without Carbon, there'd be no vegetables. Every time I eat a grape, I smile to myself at night. I enjoy red grapes at night, or I eat organic grapes most every night of my life. That's the fruit I prefer. I like grapes an awful lot. But I look at the grape and I say to myself, don't these idiots understand that without global warming, there'd be no grapes on the earth? In other words, the original global warming that ended the Little Ice Age, which occurred only a few hundred years ago, 400 years ago, was ended with a slight warming of the earth's atmosphere, permitted the advent of massive agriculture throughout the earth. And that's how we have grapes, boys and girls, and plums, and all of the other good things, and all of the birds, and the bees love it too. You see, if we had less carbon and less warming, we'd have more ice and more snow, and all the birds and bees would die. They'd fall out of the sky. And then you look at carbon. I'm a car lover, for example, and I love composites. That's the latest, you know, hot buzzword, the McLaren composite. The Ferraris have part composite material. The Mercedes McLaren SLR was a composite car. The Porsche Carrera GT, the Lexus LFA, the Lamborghini Sesto Elemento. These are all partially fiber chassis constructed cars. So when you hear the word composite, people don't know what it means. I have no idea what carbon fiber means. It's an interesting word, like, oh, it's carbon fiber, it's expensive. Well, it is. And I say hurrah for carbon. Can anyone tell me nature's best known composite design? I'm going to do a science question maybe once a day. What is nature's best known composite design? Nature's now, not man's. Whoever can answer that question will win a free copy of Abuse of Power, my best-selling novel. The question again is, what is nature's best-known composite design? And then I'm going to tell you what a composite is. I can tell you right now. By the way, composites in manufactured goods didn't begin 5 years ago. The first structural composite road car was the Lotus Elite by Colin Chapman in 1957, which used monolithic GRP glass-reinforced plastic. But what many of you don't know, that's moldings glued together to make a composite monocoque design, right? Moldings glued together. It was made of glass-reinforced plastic in 1957. Did you know that before this, both the 1950s Ford T-Bird and the Chevy Corvette had used GRP for semi-structural body and body components? I don't know if you know this. In other words, the composite concept goes back to the 1950s. How about your fishing rods? Some sporting goods are made from glass composites, with some carbon being used in a glass carbon hybrid structure, fishing rods, for example. The wood of a tree is made of fibers and resin, and it gives a tree its ability to bend in the wind without snapping. And, of course, the same concept, the same principles, are used to make the frames of many cars on the high end of the cars today, the carbon composite cars today. Carbon fiber, it's very interesting. I actually have a car with carbon fiber in it. I have a few cars and other things, which I've earned, by the way. I didn't take it from you. I didn't take it from the people with flies coming out of their hair in Wall Street in Zucchini Park. I earned it. I pay my taxes. I work hard. I'm not allowed to own a car with carbon fiber in it. I'm not allowed to own a boat if I pay taxes on the fuel and on the boat. You should tell me what I can own. That's how it works in a fascist dictatorship. Will you, the unwashed, illiterate, jealous masses, control the society? And what happens is, eventually, the society comes to a grinding halt. Just take a look at the ex-Soviet Union, look at communist China before it modified its economic system. Take a look at any other system that was heavily controlled by the government, and you'll see what will happen if you let the rotting vegetables in Zucchini Park have their day in the sun. I love how all the liberals, everything they ever talked about, I am, and yet they refuse to acknowledge I exist. Everything they ever dreamed of being, I have become. The independent man, the Renaissance man, the man who walks alone, the man who marches to a different beat, the man who marches to a different drummer. Here I am, best-selling author in nonfiction, now switches to fiction, and in his first shot out of the park, knocks it out of the park. Not one word in an American newspaper. So would it change my life? It doesn't, really. The end of the day, I mean, was it Paul who said all is vanity? I get that. Okay, the Klieg lights, the flashbulbs, the listings, the Academy Awards. What does it really mean at the end of the day? You think when Martin Scorsese goes home, takes off the suit and tie, takes off the jacket, and lays down in his bed, what do you think he thinks about? What does he say? I'm a great man because I got an Academy Award, or I'm not a great man because I didn't get an Academy Award? No, I don't know what he thinks. I mean, you know, you are what you are. I mean, I know from the inside some very famous directors. I've heard from insiders who knew them. Like on New Year's Eve, they were sending around suicidal notes about how lonely they are. Big liberals, big libs saying that they feel like committing suicide because they're alone. So don't assume that what you see on TV is what people are. Everyone's the same at the end of the day. I don't care whether you're a president or a janitor. At the end of the day, when you lay down in bed, and it's you and your dreams and God, if you still understand that there is a God, it doesn't matter whether you believe in God because he's there whether you believe in him or not. See, that's how that works. He doesn't need you. You need him. Holy man once said that to me.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
The best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? You think you've seen the sun, but you ain't seen
it. It is the Savage Nation. We're changing pace a little bit on the show, as I told you. There's only so much I can take of the communists in the gutters of America and the Marxists in the White House. And I've spelled it out for you in trickle-up poverty, and I've fictionalized it in abuse of power. So at this point, we move to a different theme altogether. My good friend, I should say my new friend, Robert Davi, is with us now on the Savage Nation. Robert, welcome from Los Angeles. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
So, Robert, let's start with the business part. You have a new CD out, correct?
Yes, it comes out Monday, the 24th, but you can also get it now on Amazon, but it comes out on...
All right, but what is it? You're not imitating Sinatra. It's your own interpretation, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not a replication or a, you know, impersonation. It's... Growing up, I won first place New York State School Music Association solo competition as in high school. I studied with Tito Gobbi in Florence. I studied with Dan Farrow from Juilliard and Samuel Margolis, who taught Robert Merrill. I did my...
I can't believe that you actually studied opera as a young man, because you always play... Basically, you play gangsters in movies, right?
Yeah, well, you know, you start off holding a gun and they keep it in your hand for the rest of your career.
So what, Robert, what was the first movie you were in? Was your first movie with Sinatra a contract on Cherry Street?
That's correct.
And what role did you play in that?
I played Mickey Sinatos, a Greek hitman.
Very
and my
funny.
My fate was sealed.
So they never let you put the gun down anymore, that you could never show the sensitive side. So after that, you could never show the sensitive side, huh?
Only in Profiler, you know, when I did Profiler. And I tried to also imbue the characters that I played with a moment, a glimmer, a glimpse of some kind of sensitivity, you know, to humanize.
You know, Rob, it's a very interesting thing, Robert. I know you're a fan of my show. You've heard me when I was on in L.A. Now a lot of guys in L.A. listen to me on the internet or whatever. I don't want to make this about me, but I have a very similar problem. In other words, yes, I believe every word I say. However, there are other aspects to my personality other than the radio show, and yet the illiberals will not let me put the gun down, so to speak.
It's an interesting dilemma, because I know when we have had dinner and stuff, absolutely, it's fascinating, and it's so frustrating. So I never thought of it that it would be frustrating for you, because having the talk radio forum, but I guess it's the same kind of frustration, only being able to express a certain part of yourself. And I guess
exactly.
That's why you wrote your book, Abuse of Power. I mean, you know, it's so it lets you...
You're 100% right. That's exactly right. I'm trying to go into another direction. If I could sing, I'd put out a CD. But I can't sing. So you're appearing tomorrow in L.A. at the where?
At the Grove. We're doing a concert. I'm doing a free concert, a dog food company called Performance. Is sponsoring the event, and it's in dedication for animals and the Humane Society of the United States.
But when you recorded these songs, the Sinatra stuff, I read you had a 55-piece orchestra. Is that true?
We had 30 pieces for the orchestra. The 55-piece orchestra was at my show that I did in Thousand Oaks that was sold out.
That's amazing. 55-piece orchestra? I didn't even know they exist anymore.
Well, you can bring them together now and then, Mike, you know. But this, on the album, it's a 30-piece orchestra. It was produced by the great Phil Ramone and mixed by Al Schmidt. And we did it at Capitol Records, Capitol Studio, where Sinatra did those great recordings during the...
I would, you know what, Robert, the next time you record, I'd love to be there, because as a man who lives by sound alone, I would love to see a large orchestra recording. I think it'd be a real kick for me, personally.
You would love it, and the engineer we had, the recording guy, Dan Wallen, is, and these guys that I used, Al Schmidt, I mean, and Dan Wallen, they're up there, but they have ears and technology better than any 20-year-old you can imagine. I mean, these are guys that helped build this industry during that golden age of recording.
Well, here's the problem, though. I'm banned in Britain. Am I banned in L.A.? I don't know what'll happen once I go through the grapevine. Will the SWAT teams get me?
Pal, you're not banned.
you and the buddies, huh?
Mike.
No, I know. Robert, look, you've been around so long. You must be, how many years? How many movies have you done?
You know, Goonies, Bond, Die Hard, Showgirls, Profile, Television. Since 1977, when I did that first film with Mr. Sinatra, and until current. I just did three films this year. And
so what makes you want to sing? It's because you began as an opera student and you really always wanted to sing? Is that what you're saying?
Well, in an Italian household, there were two figures, the Pope and Frank Sinatra. And not necessarily in that order.
And that's very funny.
Singing has always been, you know, the Italian tradition. I mean, we listened around the house. You know, I was listening to Caruso, Sinatra, Dean Martin, you know, the great Italian popular songs, and I always had... Singing was a...
Well, wait a minute. You say there were two figures, the Pope and Frank Sinatra. How about Rocky Marciano?
Well, of course. And Joe DiMaggio. But I'm just saying, the two eminent figures, there were... Every household, not everybody may have liked boxing or baseball, but Sinatra and the Pope, you had to like.
That's amazing. You know, when I was younger, I had some Italian friends, and even though they were from the uneducated classes, as was my family, and there's nothing wrong with that, they just were poor, they loved opera. The Italian families would listen to opera whether or not they had education. That's an amazing fact, and it's disappeared. I don't think anyone listens to opera anymore. Do you? I mean, I didn't say anybody, but it's a very small audience today.
A very small audience, but the, you know, I was very involved, and even Sinatra in his day had the largest, when he was a teenager, he had one of the largest collections of classical music, Sinatra. He was trained on the bel canto technique. He trained from a guy from the Metropolitan Opera, and that is where, you know, this great sound is. I think when we met, we talked a little bit about that voice, and Gary Catona, who's been training me for the last several years, captures that. He has a tremendous technique in terms of the voice and singing.
That's what I want to ask you about, Robert, voice. Okay, I live by my voice, okay, and my brain, putting the two together. every day for all these years. And people said to me, you've got such a wonderful voice. You're an expert on voice. I'm really not an expert. Your voice is what? Are you a baritone?
I'm a baritone.
Okay. What would my voice be?
I would think baritone. I would be a bass baritone. You would be baritone. And
so yours is deeper than mine, right?
You don't know until the singing and then how high you can go. In other words, when I sing, my voice, I get about a 3-octave range that I can eke out.
Yeah.
But on the timbre of your voice, I would say it's a baritone voice.
But how do you learn to sing? How would I learn to sing? I've always fantasized about singing. I sing sometimes to the dog, but I wouldn't dare sing anywhere else.
Well, you know, if you have a passion for it, first it's the, you know, I was so inundated at a young age, and I'm talking about, you know, at 7 years old, Michael, I was down in the basement of my family's house listening to those old wind-up record players my grandpa.
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
Putting on those 78 records and yes. Studying the different voices from opera to even the Sinatra, because the sound there was pure. It wasn't manufactured, you know, electronically. There was a very...
Well, I had old Caruso. My father was a little antique dealer. We had old... I had old Caruso records I listened to on the Victrola, so to speak.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, that's the great tradition with the Italians and Jews, you know.
All right, Robert, here, I'm going to take a chance. You know I'm a guy who takes chances. You ready for this? Let's have some fun. I'm going to try to sing one line of something, whatever comes to my mind, just for you. Tell me what you hear. You ready? This is a signature test. You ready? If it's crap, just say awful, terrible. Don't think about it. Okay?
Go ahead.
Robert, here we go. I need the downbeat. One, two, one, two. Be my love. How's that as a starter?
it's very cute. I mean, be my love. You know, Mario Lanza made that famous. I mean, so I
see, I was just doing it to get some laughter going here. I don't want this to be too stiff. I don't know what to sing. I mean, I could start singing in Hebrew. I would sound better than I would be singing in English. You want me to do my cantor voice? Let me do a cantorial for you. How's that? Then I'll stop it. We'll go back to you.
Mishpocha, do the cantor.
Oh, come on. You're Italian. Stop it. Here we go. Baruchu es Adonai Hamaroch li'olam voed. How's that?
That's very good. That was
okay.
Very good. Nice open.
See, so the next time you have a movie where a Jewish gangster is being buried, let's say someone from the 40s, and you need someone to play a cantor, think of me.
You know what? I will.
You took me seriously.
No, because, you know, I don't know if it'll work out, but I wrote a new script, and there is a cantor in it who teaches my character the song Raisins and Almonds in Yiddish.
I don't believe it.
I swear.
Robert, this is an intriguing part of you. Wait a minute, you wrote and directed a movie, didn't you, that you sent me about 2 years ago?
Yes, of course.
I love that movie. With all your friends were in it, one of them died, the fat guy died, right?
Yes, yeah, Frank D'Amico.
I loved him. I loved him in that movie.
Show, Frank D'Amico, by the way.
Oh, my God. See, there's so many guys out there who I would love to know who live for this show because I sound like them or like someone they knew. I never meet these guys. And that goes to the old joke I told you earlier. Lenny Bruce once said an Irishman from New York is more Jewish than a Jew from Cleveland, and you thought that was funny. But the truth is that a Polish man in Chicago is more Italian than an Italian from San Francisco.
Yes. I guess you go, no. the further north you go up to, it becomes a little bit less, you know, don't forget all those guys in the south. Same thing in Italy, probably.
Well, what do you mean in Italy? How is it the same in Italy?
Well, no, I'm being, you know, as you get closer to the Swiss and German border, you know, there's a different kind of Italian that goes along.
Oh, of course. That's right. They all try to act like they're wasps.
You know, there's a different where the.
No, I remember for years I would hear Italian people say to me, "Oh, I don't eat that Sicilian stuff, that Sicilian food. I only eat Northern Italian food." And you know, all the Italian food I ever loved is the heavy, spicy Southern Italian Sicilian food myself.
Oh, it's so good. Even the Southern Italians have like my father
of
was.
Hey, Robert, you want to stay on another segment for fun? I don't want to do politics.
Absolutely. Whatever you'd like to do.
Are you kidding? Okay, we'll be right back. Be here or be nowhere.
Savage.
Robert, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, what are the lyrics from That's Life? It's I've been a puppet, a poet, a prawn and a king, or
I've
a pawn and a king?
A puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, pawn and a king. I've been
I always thought it was a prawn because prawn. The Italians eat so many shrimp.
That would be scungili then. No, it's not a pawn.
I've been a puppet, a poet, a pawn and a scungili and a king. Now, you see, Robert, one of the things I loved about meeting you was that you know how to laugh. Why is it that people don't laugh anymore? What happened to this world?
I don't know. They don't understand the absurdity of life.
You know, that's the truth. Is it a generational thing, Robert? I mean, your friends laugh, don't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, sometimes we cry. You know, I just did a film in Toronto, and I got to tell you, there's a community there. I mean, yeah, people laugh. You know, I think the closer you are to an immigrant population.
Yeah. Yes.
The closer you are to your grandparents, if they were immigrants. The more sense of fun, even though the struggle was so difficult.
Yeah, they were poorer, but they knew how to laugh and cry. We're living in a time where people are on so many different medications, and they're also afraid to express emotion, Robert.
They're told not to feel.
Well, I don't know if they're told not to feel. They don't feel. Well, they don't express themselves at work. They're afraid to say anything that they actually believe. The boys are told to shut their mouths in school, and they grow up like rigid dummies. So let's go back to what you're doing. I don't want to get into the philosophical till we have a few glasses of wine and we can sing, That's Amore. When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's Amore. You know, Robert, when I was a kid and I would listen to Dean Martin, which I did very often coming from Queens, New York, I was amazed by those lyrics because, of course, as a kid, I didn't drink. But as I got older and occasionally got drunk when I was 17, 18, the moon looks like a pizza pie when you get drunk. It really does.
Covered in that delicious cheese. It's a little red.
No, but the moon starts to shine when the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore. In other words, the drunker you are, the moon shines more, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Absolutely. Those writers know, boy, let me tell you. And that's the thing.
That's why I don't drink much anymore. Who wants to see a moon that's so big? So, Robert, okay, your album is out Monday. What's the name of it? What's on it? Where do people order it?
It's called Davi Sings Sinatra on the Road to Romance. It was produced by the legendary Phil Ramone. Fontana Universal is putting it out. You can get it in stores everywhere. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it in Barnes & Noble and all different stores, Suncoast. So wherever things are sold.
But Robert, your shows, your singing shows are selling out, I understand, correct?
Yes, they are, and I'm getting, you know, It's embarrassing to say, but even the musicians I'm working with, that some have worked with Mr. Sinatra for many years, giving me, the best thing I could say is go to the website, DaviSingSinatra.com, and there are quotes from some amazing people.
Here's what I'm getting at. Why do you think that the singing tours are selling out? What's going on in America? Is there a quest for nostalgia from a different time? When Sinatra was at his peak, America was a different country. It was a far different country, was it not?
It was. But here's the kicker for me. The Great American Songbook is the Shakespeare of America. It's the golden age of American music. And when my parents grew up and times were difficult, this music, even though times were, if a guy was breaking up with his woman, there was a beautiful poetic lyric that was written about it. If you look
yes.
at the song that won the Academy Award in, let's say, 1958, All the Way, as opposed to what won the Academy Award a few years ago, It's Hard Out There for a Pimp. Culturally and emotionally, this
yes.
the music, the American Songbook, which I have to say, it was written, if you look at who wrote that book, Harold Arlen, Yip Harburg. Harold Arlen was a Cantor's son. Sammy Kahn, Jimmy Van Heusen, Cy Coleman, Carolyn Lee, Frank Lesser. They were all Jewish.
Don't tell that to the Occupy Wall Street crowd. They're liable to say they should be kicked out of America. Robert, let's not get into politics. I know you want to stick to art and music, and I do too, and movies, which is very exciting. But I think it's amazing that you're making a transition from your acting career back to your original love, which is your singing career, which is astonishing to me. But there's another element to this, I think, as a social commentator. I have noted for years now on my show that wherever you go in this country, let's say I'm shopping in Macy's, right? They're playing the music in the background. It's very rarely a male vocalist. It's always this whiny chick music. That's what I always hear. I'm in a dressing room. I feel like sticking myself with pins until to get out of there. I can't even. All you hear is a whiny chick music everywhere. It's like bad elevator music. You don't hear the baritones anymore. That's what I'm getting at. Maybe it's because America wants a baritone again, the Dean Martin, the Frank Sinatra, that you're experiencing this success in addition to your talent.
Yeah, I hope so. I know that, you know, I'll be at the Venetian in February, February 23rd, 24th, 25th, and that was where the Sands Hotel used to be.
Huh.
And I'm very excited about that.
I want to be there. Robert, that's one night I really want to fly into Vegas. I want to do that night.
That would be great. It would be great.
What's it like after a show? I know that when I do a live performance, I can't think after a show. When you're through singing, what do you do after the end of a show?
You know, that the moment of doing the show, you know what that is. What that you're on the wire there. You know, it's the excitement. It's amazing. And when you have a big orchestra behind you, and you're connecting from the music is channeling through you to the audience. It's hard to come down afterwards, you know? It's just an amazing...
That's the thing. How can you sit down and have a plate of pasta and talk to anybody? It's impossible. Impossible.
You can't. So you got to have a few drinks first, and then you can talk.
No, it's true. And the people don't know this. They think that because you're an entertainer, you're going to sit down and be a grand old friend. They don't understand that you're drained. You're somewhere else. Your nerves are shot. You're in another world. You're on a high wire. And they want to just, you know, sit down with you and get some of that energy. It's impossible to be with people.
It is. That's
why I don't do live performances anymore. It's just me and Teddy in the room now doing radio. Because this way I'm down all the time, Robert. And when you're down so long, it starts to look like up to you. You know what I mean? That old line.
Yeah. That was very good. That's very good.
Robert, listen, it's always a pleasure. I wish I lived in L.A. because you and I would become fast friends. I can guarantee it.
Savage.